This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Alison Mulder,
Stu Schwartz,
and Jane Bolton.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Stu, you have been collecting Kiwiana for quite some time, have you?
More than 25 years. Yeah, we've been here 28 years. When I left the employ of the Science Center and Manawatu Museum, I started to collect in earnest. I didn't collect during the time that I was the foundation director there, because normally one doesn't compete with one's institution. And until I left there, I basically directed all the things that I saw to the museum's collection. But after I left and was a free spirit, I decided that I was enthralled by what I saw. We had put up an exhibition in 94 on called Kiwiana, Kiwiana, which came out of Auckland. Put together by two curators up there and displayed at the Science Center and Manawatu Museum in those early years. And I was fascinated with it. And because I was an archaeologist and anthropologist by training, material culture thrills me.
So you already had this interest while you were in America for things in America, and then you...
Yeah, I just transferred them to here. I mean, if I was going to learn how to be a real Kiwi, this exhibition was very helpful because it was set up by rooms where various things were, where Kiwis would make them or import them or use them or whatever. And there was a whole string of the usual things you think of from the standpoint of standard Kiwiana. I mean, you know... jandals and buzzy bee and black singlets and Aunt Daisy, Edmund's cookbooks, all of those sort of things.
So those are the stuff. Now, they do say if you're traveling or you go somewhere new, take photographs early on of the things that stand out, because after a while it becomes normal. So when you came to New Zealand, Were those are the standard things people would say? These are Kiwiana, the buzzy bee, and so on.
Well, that's what was.
Was that generally the sort of thing that stood out for you?
Yes, but I soon realized that the life in Kiwiland was normal and every day, and there were things that weren't necessarily on those lists that were provided.
So was it very different from in the United States?
Not really.
No.
Not really. Perhaps the names we called things.
Okay, yes.
You know, gumboots were galoshes.
Yeah.
Things of that nature.
Yeah. And now they're Red Band, aren't they?
Yeah, Red Band is one of the big brands.
England,
yeah. But, there wasn't much different. I mean, foods were a little different.
The cars would have been different.
Cars certainly were different, driving on the opposite side from what I was used to.
Yeah, and cars would have been a lot smaller and older, were they?
Older.
I think as a general rule, yes. If you looked at the greatest number of automobiles that are bought in this country, and still, 28 years later from when we arrived, a smaller version... works well, and part of that is due to the narrowness of roads. And
you think the roads in New Zealand are narrow?
They were initially for me.
Have you seen the roads in England?
only on the Antiques Road Trips television show, where you're lucky to get down one lane.
If you come here from England, the roads seem incredibly wide. What a waste of space!
Yeah. And of course, we're building magnificent roads now, freeways, etc., and highways that are as good as anywhere in the world. But for the most part, cars were smaller, and there were still big cars. I mean, there were folks who could afford bigger cars. They had bigger families, needed bigger cars, etc. Nothing more, though, that I'm reminded of a good friend of mine whose father was a farmer in Virginia, and he liked his luxury. I mean, they had an air-conditioned device that harvested, you know, harvester, basically, etc. Yeah. But he used a Lincoln Town Car as his farm car, drive around the paddocks, and he just liked luxury, and that's the at that time it was the biggest American car ever. And but you know, he could afford it, and he loved it, and that's what he did. So
So I think the impression for me would be New Zealand's a mix of American and English type influence. Is that
I would concur with that. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, today, after being here 28 years, the foreign influences are really taking over.
Yes.
I suppose we have more Asians here than were 25 years ago, and people from around the world are finding out what a wonderful place this is and manipulating the system so they can live here. And we're very fortunate to be in New Zealand, particularly this day and time. But I we came over with permanent residency, and as soon as we were able, we applied for citizenship because we wanted to be a part of this. And the collecting of Kiwiana was all that. It was to amass the things, from a museum standpoint, the things that would have made us Kiwis, and the kind of things that I think if my mother and father had been Kiwis and I had been born here, I would have taken for granted.
Yeah.
But because
were they mainly made in New Zealand?
Pardon?
Kiwiana, is it mainly made in New Zealand?
There's a lot made in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, these days, more and more is going overseas. I mean, people who said that they would never manufacture overseas have had to change their story.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to survive and make money, and be able to support the staff and families, then you've got to go overseas, which is a shame.
But basically, it's wrong.
Yeah, but I have always felt, and again, this is really an aside, I suppose, that the world should be divided into manufacturing sectors, because for me, I mean, the best cars are probably still made in the Scandinavian countries. Volvo and those sort of things make the safest automobiles. But the best refrigerators are still made in Amana, in Ohio, in the States. So, you know, if you were looking around the world, who makes the best this or that, that's the way it should be. But, of course, it isn't.
Well, but this can change. This can change over time.
Oh, of course it can change over time.
The sense of shipbuilding has moved from one country to another.
It has changed over time.
You also mentioned, though, to take a slightly different tack, you say you took out New Zealand citizenship. Now, two things. One, coming from America, are you allowed now to have dual citizenship, or did you have to renounce your American citizenship?
We came out here in 92. In 1989, the Supreme Court ruled that if you wanted dual citizenship with a country that was friendly to America, you could have it.
Oh, okay.
So there's you know, potential dual citenship.
So they allowed it.
Did you have
lots
to go back to America for a certain length of time? Or you didn't have to?
No.
And the other thing, because I came here from elsewhere as well, and I was surprised that there wasn't the sort of move from New Zealand. In fact, I know people who came out from Britain in the early 1950s who are still just permanent residents because there was no difference in their rights here under that status. Whereas my experience in some other countries, they'd be thinking, you know, are you going to take out citizenship? Are you going to? It was considered important here. For New Zealanders, it didn't seem to be relevant. Did you feel any?
New Zealand is a member of the Commonwealth, and they felt that if you were born in the Commonwealth, you had equal rights to be a citizen here. Yeah. And in a lot of cases, if you were from Britain, you didn't need. So you were automatically considered a citizen. Like a citizen.
Not now,
yes,
so
but
not,
to get not, a New Zealand now, passport and citizenship was a different status.
But we used to have fun with the two passports because when we traveled back to the States more recently, we basically traveled on our New Zealand. When we went to the States, we went with the American passport because that was the shorter lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, the longer lines were New Zealanders and others, yes. You know, waiting yes. to get through. Okay, coming back, we would use our New Zealand passport.
Which affects your duty-free allowance as well.
Yeah. But, you know, so it's useful.
Yeah. Yes.
But certainly in the days of 9/11, New Zealand passport was the safer thing to travel to travel with. So, so we did. So we're very fortunate from that standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, back to Kiwiana now. How do you gather it then?
Every day. Off shops. People give me things. I used to do a series of presentations on my collection. And in fact, these days anybody asks me, at the top of a hat, I talk about my collection, and ultimately, people say, "Oh, I've got one of those," or "I've got something that would like," and I get items donated. And one of the reasons I don't sell anything is because a lot of the items have been given with the idea that perhaps they'll be in a museum. Well, right at the moment, it's a virtual museum, but I do take a couple of banana boxes full of selected items. To talks and presentations.
So you're uploading images onto the web for these?
Say
it's virtual?
Not yet.
So, yes.
Not yet. Oh, it will be.
I'm hoping it will be, yeah.
And are you gathering stories around the objects? Or just
in a lot of cases, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm more interested in the stories. Right at the moment, I'm a member of the Te Manawa Museum Society, and we're working very hard to get images. The first group of things are in childhood related objects, and to get those up and to connect the story with them if we know it, or to tell about the object anything that we can learn, and that will be very useful in the future, so that digital imagery of the Te Manawa collections will happen, but it just won't happen overnight. There are a number of institutions. The Nelson Museum, Taranaki, they have wonderful collections online. And right now we're really lagging behind. But hopefully, in the years to come, that will change and the public will be able to see the collections of Te Manawa.
For the staff to do, or you've got volunteers who are doing that?
Basically, the Museum Society is doing it as a volunteer effort. Never been enough staff.
Yeah,
at Te Manawa to do all of that.
Yeah,
But, yeah, hopefully.
Are there many volunteers? What sort of group?
Not as many as we would like, but the Museum Society board and members are keen to move the project forward. So it will happen, yeah. A lot of good information. We've had professional photographers take photos, so we've got good images to throw up online, and what we have to do is just develop a story or information about the object. And, of course, a lot of cases, with things given to Te Manawa, there are family stories behind. And
did they do much audio in relation to these things? I'm thinking of overseas museums where often you have an exhibit and there'd be either a button to press or a sort of phone receiver to pick up and you hear a short
description. Not to the extent that we should. I hope in the future exhibits of local history, etc., will have that. When they buy in an exhibition to share with the public in the area, there may be a component of recordings available, and we encourage people to use that. But all of that needs time and money and staff.
Yes.
Volunteers. So it's a slow process.
Yeah, it was my impression when I first started doing the recording, both with Te Manawa and with the city archive, that even if they've got people who are trained to do it, they don't have the time to put into to doing a lot of that sort of work.
No, the things you've been doing, encouraging people to talk about their lives, and put that information into the library archives, is going to be a manna from heaven in the future.
Hopefully it works.
Yeah, it's a wonderful project.
Yeah, well, people have lots to say, and you just give them a chance.
Yes. You have to say yes and stay saying yes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, back to Kiwiana.
Yes.
The Schwarzenian Museum of Kiwiana is in my mind for the most part, and I can see it. And part of the problem, of course, is money. I mean, I once considered finding the funds to buy the old Mitre 10 building down on Rangitiki Line. I thought it had enough space inside, but obviously never put the funds together. I also looked at the building that Razine is in, which was the old Freedom Company building, and I lost out to Razine. Again, they had more money than I did. But, you know, in the future, hopefully. One of the things that I contemplated was, instead of building a purpose-built building or inhabiting a building that exists, a commercial-type structure, is to find a two- or three-story old villa or house that we could create into a museum. Furnish rooms with furniture, objects in cupboards, in drawers, whatever, and let people explore and provide information on cards and handouts, etc. Make it a real hands-on experience. And that might come if somebody wants to donate a house to us. We'd be happy to take it over.
With your experience with museums anyway, you'd know how to set those things out.
And I'd love to do it. But in the meantime, collecting has been a real joy. And not only people who donate things and are appreciative that somebody's taking an interest in these objects and saving them. I remember, just as a throwback, when I was directing, I was curator of history at the Mint Museum of Art in Charlotte, North Carolina. One of the things we were doing was going to be a military display celebrating the end of the war. And we put the word out. We would love to have donated uniforms and paraphernalia that people would have used during, you know, soldiers would have used during the war. Waves, wax, Army, Navy, Air Force, etc. And we thought we'd get a few, over 300 full uniforms showed up. In the historic house that I was running as part of being curator of history, we strung clothesline in the attic and sorted the clothes that way. People were just so pleased that the museum was interested in these things. They had been in their closets since the end of World War II, they were just delighted to give them to an organization that would take care of them, et cetera. And, you know, amazing numbers of things showed up. And, basically, if we put out a word here, the same thing would happen. That there are people holding on to things just waiting for an opportune moment to give it away.
So you've organized a group around you to help with this, or at the moment it's basically you and your support of or opposition of your wife while you're doing this?
Phyllis is a very tolerant lady. No, I don't have a committee, so to speak. I certainly have friends who are interested in helping develop the committee, but right at the moment it's mostly stored in a warehouse and throughout our house.
Your poor wife. Your poor wife.
Yes, this is true. She's getting very claustrophobic. But I don't have any other place to put it. So, I mean, the two-car garage, garage isn't a two-car garage anymore. It's storage for the collection. The computer room is storage for the collection. The second and third bedrooms are storage for the collection. The hallway leading to the back deck. God forbid there was a fire, you'd never get out that door. Yes.
And she knows that if she gave the ultimatum, either those things go or I go, then she'd lose.
It would be a difficult day.
Difficult decision.
Yes.
If you did digital cataloging as you collect it, you could go digital before you get your building.
Well, this is true. Only half the collection has been cataloged. The first half never got cataloged. It was coming so fast and furious that it basically wound up in boxes and in storage. But last number of years, I've been writing down everything that I put in boxes, and that could be typed, but it would be a massive job, massive job. I mean, I've got notebooks full of, you know, 200 pages each or more, line by line, of stuff that...
So you're not computerized in this, so you can't word search and sort?
No, but someday. I mean, I'm hoping that if I live long enough and my retirement continues, then I'll have the opportunity to do that in the future. Right at the moment, there are other things that are pressing, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to catalog and put things online and also put things on display. It's a big dream. It drives me, and I've learned an awful lot about being a Kiwi and about New Zealand history.
Are you aiming to cover everything, or there's certain sorts of items you have a particular...
Well, I tell people who are interested in giving things that as long as it can come through the front door, and in this case it was the gallery where I was collecting things, I think Phyllis is very pleased I don't collect traction engines or farm equipment. There are other people doing that.
You were mentioning that.
I'm collecting small everyday items, and like today.
Does that include toasters and
It includes posters. Toasters.
Those are food processors
That sort of thing. Sunbeam items made by Sunbeam here.
Just take one example of each kind of item, or do you take...
No, museum people are funny. Museum people are funny. When you put something on display, you might have to show the front and the back and the side. Yes. So, you know, if you don't have three of everything, it's not complete.
Exactly. In fact, good display.
And they all have a number on, like the prison profile photos.
Well, they will have. We'll have a number, but hopefully won't be obvious. But it will have to be cataloged correctly.
Yeah. Is there a system, you know, like Dewey Decimal for library books? Is there a similar system for cataloging museum exhibits?
There are several systems. Depends upon, you know, what you start. But if you number the first item with the year you got it, the number of the collection, the number within that collection, there are other things that you can list. But basically what you're looking at is the year of accession. And if it was a collection of items, that collection has a number. And then every object within that collection has its own number. And that's basic system of putting things into a catalog. Yeah.
So except with Dewey Decimal, you can say this is the subject area, and you've got some standard thing with the museum collection numbering system. It doesn't quite work that way.
Normally, we don't work on a Dewey Decimal
approach. Oh, no, you wouldn't. I'm thinking of an equivalent.
Yeah. It would probably be closer to what the library is these days in putting things in categories and related things together. That system drives me crazy, trying to find things. Yeah. I like the old Dewey Decimal system. Yeah. But put things like things together, or things that should be seen together or grouped together. That will happen ultimately in the display process and in the final storage.
So you'd have sort of categories, kitchenware, living room, and so on, and then this is 1950s, 1960s.
Yep, you can develop collections all around those sort of things. Yep.
Are there any particular things that you want that you haven't got yet? Someone might hear this.
The money to buy a building and outfit it with shelving and cases and security would be the priority. So that's why I buy lotto tickets every week. not necessarily a gambling man, but I keep my fingers crossed. Yeah.
Are you likely to get financial support from the council?
The world is changing. You never know. But I think a project like this for Pommy might elicit some funds. But I mean, I think museums and the stuff in museums are important for learning and education, heritage. But we also have to have roads, playgrounds, schools. I mean, there are lots of ways you can spend money.
Yeah.
And at the current stage, I can't connect what I'm doing, et cetera, to the virus. So I'm probably out of luck over there.
But yeah.
Because we're certainly spending a lot of money. I don't know where it's coming
from.
But we are spending a lot of money. But, the museum will happen, I'm hoping. Certainly the collection exists, and it's exciting.
About how many? Any idea roughly how many items you've got?
100,000.
And in a normal museum, well, I mean, there's all different sizes of museums, but just is that a lot? If it was all on display, is that a massive museum, an average size?
Well, it'd never be all on display. Most museums internationally put about 5% of their collections, change them, et cetera. I mean, that's the whole idea. But, you select the best. You select the objects that tell a story, provide information. And
Now, how far is this you giving the story or the object, the stories inherent in the objects?
Well, 50-50. Some cases, stories come with objects.
Yeah.
People can tell you family histories, and we've been good at Tamano. We've been good at collecting like that. For the Schwarzonian, in a lot of cases, pieces were dropped off, and unless I followed up on who gave it, in some cases they wouldn't know themselves. You know, this came out of Grandma's estate, I don't know whether she bought it or somebody gave it to her, that sort of thing. So there is a lack of information.
Yeah.
But sometimes the objects speak for themselves and are very, very special.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think where I heard somewhere that they said the story is so important. So maybe for a museum object, the story behind the object or a story behind the object just adds so much value.
Well,
the
object is a three-dimensional object, and tied to it is why it exists, how it was used, where it's going to wind up. Those sort of things—they're all story potentials. And the interpretation of an object is what we try to do best. Tell why the object is relevant in today's life is one of the things. And of course, history. Where's it been? Where's it going?
Yeah.
How has it affected other people's lives? How has it affected your life?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And all of those, the right interpretation of an object can make it really come alive.
And there's other dimensions as well, though, because often you might look at things from today's perspective, this is how we see this. Would it have been seen the same way 100 years ago, maybe? I mean, I think, you know, household objects and so on, now there's very much probably the gender and nature of household labour interpretation, whereas I don't know if there would have been a different... You know, the current issues shape what we're looking for and how we interpret them.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible to sort of pick up how this might have been perceived at the time, or is there an awareness that can change over time?
Well, I mean, basically, if you're looking at objects, let's say, archaeologically, they might exist. And why, for instance, we don't particularly care for people who are called potholers, or even metal detector people who basically dig down a shovel, remove that object from the other objects that it relates to. Those things are of importance. How does it relate to other objects? Why it exists in the first place? And, who made it, who used it?
Yeah.
And, of course, we're dumbfounded sometimes to find that there's nothing new under the sun. You look at these wonderful television programs on Pompeii.
Yes, absolutely.
Herculaneum that I saw the other night.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just striking.
Yeah.
Basically, we probably it's probably nothing new under the sun.
And there's lots of older civilizations that were old and disappeared before Pompeii and so on that we're now finding the remains.
Yeah, I was blown away yesterday visiting a fellow who I've got to do some repair work for me on an object. He showed me a sketch of basically a large piece of granite, I think, that exists in Palenque, a Mayan city in Mexico, a very important site, which illustrates, in his mind, a spaceship. And with a pilot, and he's an engineer. He went ahead and built a model. He thinks there's one of these full size at Palenque. I'm not sure he's going to find the funding to go get it or influence people. But yeah, you know, I'm a believer in UFOs, and there's no reason to believe that the Mayans weren't visited by people, and they somehow carved into this magnificent rock the story and showing. If you saw the model and the sketch,
yeah, I've seen the picture,
you'd be dumbfounded. I mean, it's amazing. There are probably more things like that around the world, but I'm a firm believer. I'd love to go out and find that.
I suppose the problem might be the outline shape of something we interpret one way when it might have been seen in a different way.
Absolutely. Like I say, this may be in somebody's mind, but it's not just in this person's mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that other people agree.
Oh, yeah. Well, what was that book? Chariot of the Gods. Chariot of the Gods.
Of the Gods. Van Daniken.
Yeah. Should look at that.
Yeah.
And there's another book. Here, have you seen that one?
Oh, you mentioned it to me the last time we did a recording. 1421. Yeah, the Chinese were everywhere.
Yeah, well, there's another, he's got another later book, 1434, I think, when they visited Italy and started the Renaissance, which you'd think it would be somewhat better documented elsewhere if that had actually happened. But
well, I mean, you know, a lot of things disappear over time, particularly documents, paper or before paper, papyrus. And animal skins and all of that sort of thing. There's probably a lot of things that have been lost.
Yeah, that's true.
We may never discover.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, some things we are. I mean, we're going over time. I might just cut this out. But you know, they were finding traces of or evidence of string from about 150,000 years ago from Israel. So we show, although we only see the solid objects now, there could have been all sorts of weaving and tool making, clothes making, and so on. And those days.
Yeah, well, even in the caves in southwest U.S., you find whole sandals made out of the leaves of corn plants, maize, woven. To make sandals, and you know, they, because of the dry conditions,
they have been
able to continue on for 200-300 years. So
Well, this one, it was more from, there were shells with holes in and marks of wear from string, which were, and then there was later on, I think in Europe, they found that just microscopic some sort of pieces, some string had been tied around something, and there were a few bits of it trace left there that you could see under a microscope.
Yeah, no. We keep looking. There are amazing things out there.
Also, well, yes.
Yeah.
We're just a blip in history, and 1,000 years from now,
it'll
all
be gone. Yeah.
This is part 3 of 4. Listen next week for part 4.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website. And a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.